Good evening. I'm assuming that most of the other people feel the way I feel tonight, would rather be home in bed. The what?
The red tent is on TV.
I don't know, what is that? Is that a...
It's about the Bible.
Well, it's always good to get a producer's version of what took place, you know. I still envision Moses, Cecil B. DeMille style, you know, coming down the mountain with the white beard.
So we're doing the first part again tonight. And so at 7 to 9, I think they're doing the first part again, and 9 to 11, the second part.
I have to be
up
by 9 o'clock.
I did.
No problem. I'll get you home way before 9 o'clock. I happen not to feel well, so it's fine. Okay, so... You know, we have, Baruch Hashem, a very, very diverse crowd in our shul. And there are those who were just absolutely, they loved the shiurim that we're giving on astrology and they couldn't get enough of it. And there were also those who, rightfully so, come from more of a scientific background, come from more of a practical background, and they didn't relate to the whole concept and they wanted a little bit more, you know, tachlis, like we say, something that's more, they can hold on to and not so be so esoteric. So tonight's class is going to end the series on astrology. It's going to connect it to Hanukkah. And we'll see how Hanukkah plays a role with this. But at the same time, I'm going to try and create a little bit more of a blend of the real world, the scientific, so to speak, together with the astrology aspect of it going into Hanukkah. And none of these are my thoughts. I'm just the compiler. I just put it together. So these are thoughts and of people who are much greater than I, who have much higher understanding than I do as well. So if nothing else, at least we can agree that we have the right to disagree. And if there are people who don't like this particular series, we're changing. We're going into, we're going to be discussing something else in 2 weeks. The month of Kislev is Sagittarius. Now to me, one of the most important things that happened in history, from my perspective, took place in the month of Kislev, and that's when I was born. So I have a personal affinity to the month, but tonight we're not going to discuss my life and we're not going to discuss my being born. We're going to discuss a few other events that took place during the month of Kislev as well. The sign of the month of Kislev, the sign of Sagittarius, is what we call the Keshes. Keshes is a bow. Now when we say a bow, there are two distinct different types of bows that we can talk about. It's called the keshes, but a bow is the rainbow. That's a basic bow that represents Sagittarius. But there's also a bow as in a bow and arrow. Now the question is, are they different? Is it the same thing? What difference does it make? Which one represents it? So we'll see. We'll see in a few minutes. According to the Gemara, Rabbi Elazar says that B'tishrei Nivra Ha'olam, the world was created in the month of Tishrei, and therefore... What connection does Kislev have with a rainbow? If the world was created in Tishrei, and if you look in Parshas Noach, you'll see that the Torah says that when Noach was in the 600th year of his life, in the second month on the 17th day, well, if the first month is Tishrei, then the second month is Cheshvan. The 17th day means the 17th day of Cheshvan, says the Torah. That's when the floods began. And it ended 40 days later because it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. So if you calculate 40 days and 40 nights from the 17th of Cheshvan, you end up right at the end of the month of Kislev, right during the Hanukkah period of time. And the Gemara teaches us that it was at that point when the Mabul was over that Noah had to sit in the ark for a year until he was able to step out onto dry land. And it was at that point that Hashem looked at Noach and said, I want to show you something. And he showed him a rainbow in the sky. And he said that this rainbow is going to be a divine covenant that there will never again be a flood that will wipe out the entire world. That was God's way of showing Noach, this is my covenant, this is a bond, there will never again be a flood that will wipe out the entire world. As a matter of fact, that was one of the mistakes that Pare made. If you remember in Mitzrayim, one of the ways that Pare was destroying the Jewish children was, he was drowning them. Why? So Chazal tell us that Pare knew that the way God interacts with the Jewish people is what we call Mida Keneged Mida, measure for measure. So Pari remembered that God made a promise he's not going to drown a major people. So if I kill the Jewish people, the Jewish children, through drowning them, I'm safe. Because if God has to pay me back measure for measure, it means he has to drown me. So he can't drown me, so therefore I can get away with this. Obviously, the basic mistake that Pari made was that Hashem said he would never destroy an entire world through drowning. He didn't say anything about an individual nation, individual people. You know, I used to think about this a lot, like, come on, is that real? That Pari knew that God pays us measure for measure? I mean, you know, how does Pari know this stuff? And I thought about it a little bit, and I realized, you know, Hitler, Yimach Shemai, when he was doing the things that he did to Jewish people, he was very, very aware of what dates he did things on. When he tattooed, because he knew that there was a halacha against tattooing, he specifically cut payas. He knew exactly what certain things were, and he specifically went after those things to make a Jew transgress what his needs to transgress. So it's not so far off that Pari should have done some research to find out how the Jews operate, what their belief structure is. As a matter of fact, I remember there was a story, the fact that Pari made that mistake and he realized it was a whole nation, you know, not a whole world, not a whole nation. There was a story that was told over a little while ago about during the war, there was these people who had escaped from whatever concentration camps. They were not caught. They were running through the woods. And at one point, they looked up and they saw a little hut in the middle of nowhere. You know, they were living on the trees. You know, they were living in the forest. They had nowhere to live. And they saw a tree and they saw some Hanukkah candles burning in the window. So they figured, oh, thank God, a safe haven. And we can be able to go there. We'll be able to get some food maybe. We'll get some clothing. Clean up, whatever it is. And as they were going to get ready to approach, one of the people realized, and I don't know the details, I don't remember if it was the first night of Hanukkah and they saw 8 lights in the window, or if it was the fourth night and they saw 5, because whoever was lighting it was counting from 8 down, not from 1 up the way we do. But there was something suspicious about the amount of lights. It wasn't correct. And he told everybody, wait a second. And they approached secretly without only one person, and they looked inside, and it was a trap. And the Nazis had set up a trap by putting the menorah in the window, and they were attracting people to come, and then they would catch them when they were, you know, since they had escaped, they would catch them and bring them in and do whatever. So the fact that there's even, they got the information, but they don't know all the information, is also a reality that we see that took place in different times. So it's not so far-fetched that Pari had the information of Mida Keneged Mida, measure for measure, but at the same time didn't know the specifics, that it didn't mean the entire, that it didn't mean a person, it meant the entire world. The Ramban says that one might think that when Noach showed the rainbow in the sky, one might actually think that there had never been a rainbow before. As a matter of fact, that is the position of the Ibn Ezra, who says that was the first time that a rainbow was ever in existence, was ever on earth a rainbow was at that point. The Ramban says, let's be real. The Ramban concludes differently. The Ramban says that the rainbow is always a phenomenon which is caused by the sun's rays passing through moist air. And when that happens, it creates a rainbow. That's the color effect that it creates, says the Ramban. He says, however, after the flood, that's when the rainbow was given the role, it was given a job of the reminder to the Jewish people of God's covenant, and to mankind, God's covenant with mankind, that he'll never do it again. So the physical rainbow may have existed, but what it represented and what it was for and what it would now be used as, that started when Hashem made that announcement to Noach, this is going to be my sign from now on. So it's possible that the physical rainbow is there, but at the same time it takes the role of the covenant after the story of Noach with Hashem. And the Ramban writes as follows. This is very, very interesting. I'm quoting you from, obviously it's translated, but I'm going to read it to you. God did not make the rainbow with its ends pointing upward. Think about this for a second. You know, we're talking about the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The way we see a rainbow with the leprechauns and all that, right? The rainbow always goes across the sky with the arch facing upwards. He says, God did not make the rainbow with its ends pointing upwards and the arch part pointing downward. He made it reversed. And the reason is that if we were pointing downwards the arch, it would seem as if the heaven was shooting arrows towards earth, because that's the arc of the bow. And that's not the impression Hashem wants to give. Hashem is giving the impression of kindness, that this is something I've forgiven you for, and therefore the arch faces away. As a matter of fact, warriors, when they carry a bow, when a warrior walks towards you with his bow pointing towards you, it means he's going to be active, because you never know when he's going to pull that arrow out and shoot. If a warrior wants to represent himself to his enemy or to the person he's coming against in peace, he puts the bow over his shoulder and he has the arch of the bow facing away from you so that you feel safe. Says the Ramban that the Rabban Shem created the rainbow in the sky with the arch facing away from us, and that's Hashem's way of letting us know that he has mercy on us. And even though a rainbow technically means we've been bad, and Hashem would like to wipe out the entire world, but he's not going to do it because he made that covenant with Noah, and therefore the ark faces away. And the Chizkuni has a very, very similar insight, and the Chizkuni writes that what's distinctive about the rainbow, and that it applies as a frequent sign, more so than almost any other sign, is that the ark of the rainbow faces downwards. And this is a symbol of peace, writes the Chizkuni. This is Hashem's way of showing us a symbol of peace, that he is forgiving us and that he's in a peaceful mode with us, and the arc of the bow faces away. So immediately we see that there's a connection a little bit, even between the arc of the rainbow and the archer's bow, because both the Ramban and the Chizkuni and others are saying that that's Hashem's way of showing us peace, and the arrows are not coming towards us, the arrows are not flying in our direction. Interestingly, Pirkei Avos writes that there were 10 things that were created in the 5th chapter of Pirkei Avos. It says there were 10 things that were created ben Hashmashos at twilight just before Shabbos. Friday morning, Friday afternoon, and just before Shabbos, in the last seconds before Shabbos, during ben Hashmashos, there were 10 things that were created in the world. And one of the 10 things that Pirkei Avos writes was created was the bow, the keshes, the rainbow. Now, first of all, would that contradict Ibn Ezra's position that the rainbow never showed up until Noach? It wouldn't, because even if Hashem created it before Shabbos in the 6 days of creation, he may never have placed it, according to Ibn Ezra, until that period of time. But again, according to the Ramban, it always existed. It's just the function of the rainbow was defined later on. So the Zohar HaKadosh takes a totally different approach, and he explains that the rainbow represents more of a level of din, of judgment. And he connects the rainbow to the Avos. I'm not going to go into the specifics, to the Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. I'm not going to go into detail because it's impossible to go through all these types of things and make it bearable and acceptable in the course of 45 minutes. But he says basically the word keshes, which means rainbow, is written kuf, shin, and then a tav, which stands for, that's the same abbreviation that we would use for tekiah, shvarim, teruah. And the tekiah, shvarim, teruah, we know are the notes that we blow during the Day of Judgment on Rosh Hashanah. And the tekiah, he says, represents Avram, the shvarim, Yitzchak, teruah, Yaakov, irrelevant at the moment why, but that's what he says. So the keshes is a representation, says the Zohar HaKadosh, of judgment. So we have almost two opposing thoughts here. We have the concept of peace, and we have the concept of judgment. It almost looks like it's two opposites and different ways of looking at it. As a matter of fact, in the bracha that Yaakov gave to Yehuda in Parshas Vayechi, which we're going to read next week, in the bracha that he gave to Yehuda, Yaakov says, your hands will be at the nape of your enemies. That's the terminology of the bracha. So the Gemara examines each bracha, what it means, what it represents. Ask the Gemara the following question. What instrument of warfare is there that requires the hand to be at the nape? And this is before fighter jets, this is before submachine guns. He said, obviously, the weapon is the bow and arrow. Because when you pull the arrow, you have to pull all the way back, and you keep your hand by the nape of your neck. So he says, also, what instrument requires hands in plural, rather than one? A hatchet, a knife, a sword, you hold in one hand. But the pasuk, the bracha says hands, yadcha, that your hands, plural. Says the Gemara, once again, it represents the bow and the arrow, because it requires two hands to work and manipulate a bow and arrow. So the bracha also represents war. And you see that the bow and arrow, the bow is a representation of war and not of peace. So it's a contradictory type of, we have two different opinions that we're getting here as to what the bow itself, is it war or is it peace or is it both? What difference does it make? So the Ramban once again says that the essence of a rainbow is in and of itself a built-in contradiction. Why? Because a rainbow is made up of sun and rain. Those are two opposite things. It's like fire and water. Theoretically, fire should put out water, water should put out fire. But the rainbow, by definition, is made up of a combination of these two things, says the Ramban. It's a contradiction in its own existence, by definition. So the Kesh, as he says, represents Hashem's attribute of active justice that brought about the destruction of the world through the Mabul. But at the same time, it's a sign of the covenant representing the divine mercy expressed by Hashem that he will never bring destruction again to the Jewish people. So the rainbow acts as both the material and a spiritual function. The material is the physical aspect of the rainbow itself, the light, the water, the clouds, that's the physical aspect of the rainbow. And the spiritual is the promise of what it represents, that God will never again destroy the world. There are several things that have the same concept of a blending of physicality and spirituality. There's a Malbim, and I'm not going to go into the Malbim in depth because it's a long Malbim, but I'm just going to give you a touch of what he says. The Malbim says that the rainbow in the Pasuk, if you look at the words in the Pasuk in Noach, it says that the bow will be seen in the clouds. Says the Malbim, the rainbow has no substance. There's nothing there. It's just a vision. You're looking at light. When the light touches the water of the clouds, it presents it, but there's no physical anything to hold on to. There's nothing to touch. But at the same time, the next Pasuk says, V'hoysa keshes ba'anan, and the bow will be in the clouds. As if to say there's some sort of a physical aspect of this rainbow at the same time. So what is that? Says the Malbim says that the physical aspect of the rainbow is the creator showing us that creation has been purified. There is a physical existence that creation has been purified when we see the rainbow in the sky. So it's both a symbol of the material struggle, and at the same time, it's a level of spirituality. Okay, when Yaakov Avinu, the Gemara says, when Yaakov Avinu looks and he says, I took Shechem, very interesting terminology, Yaakov says, I took Shechem away from the Amori, bekashti, becharbi, uvekashti, with my sword and with my bow. But in Tillim it says that Yaakov said he never used weapons. You know, I didn't have to rely on weapons. So what does it mean? So the Gemara says, when Yaakov says charbi, it means tefillah, it means prayer. And when he says kashti, it doesn't mean keshes, like my bow, but keshes has the same word as the word bakasha, my requests, my davening, my tefillos. Yaakov was victorious through his tefillos. And the Kotzker Rebbe says an unbelievable thing. He says, the same way you have a bow and an arrow, if you want that arrow to travel a long distance, it's totally dependent on the amount of energy and force that you put into pulling back on the string of the bow. And the further you pull back, and the harder you pull back, and the more effort you put into the pull, the further the arrow is going to go, the more effect it's going to have, the harder it's going to hit, and you're going to accomplish that which you want. Says the Kotzker Rebbe that tefillah, prayer, is the exact same thing. Before you open your mouth, and before you say that pasuk, and before you say that kapitel tilim, the deeper you go inside, the further you pull back within, the more sincere you are about the prayer that you are about to give out, the stronger it will travel, the further it will get, the more effect it will have. If you just do it on a very little surface level, like boing, the arrow will fall before it goes anywhere. But if you get into your prayer, and you understand it, and you understand what you're getting into, and you put yourself into it, and you ask Hashem the way it needs to be asked. You know, my son asked me this week about a situation, whatever it was, and I told him there's two different kinds of thank yous. Here's two types of thank yous. Thank you, number one. You're appreciative to somebody. You walk by and say, oh, by the way, excuse me a second. I just wanted to say thank you for what you did. You should know, it's really important. He was asking me about davening. Sometimes a person's not in the mood of davening. You're not in the mood of praying. You're not into it. You don't get into it. So I explained to them, there's two types of thank yous. The first type of thank you is, thanks a lot, I appreciate everything you did. I got to run. I'll see you later. And you go on. The second thank you is when you look at somebody and say, excuse me, do you have 5 minutes for me? I got to talk to you for a minute. You sit the guy down, you look him in the eye, say, listen, I know you don't do whatever you do for appreciation. If you only knew how much I appreciated what you do for me, you don't have to do it. And I understand you don't have to. But I'm so grateful for what you've done and how you've done it. And I just really wanted to convey my thanks to you. Both of them are a thank you. But obviously the second one is received with so much more feeling and with so much more, I want to do anything I can for that second person. When you talk to somebody and you look them in the eyes, it's so different than when you text them. I think personally one of the biggest destructions of the world we have today is everybody texting each other. I've seen people sitting on a bus. I'm not kidding. I've seen people sitting on a bus texting each other from one seat to the next instead of talking to each other. It's horrible. There's no communication. And it destroys the way we think about communicating as well. Says the Kutzker, when you want to daven, it's like a bow and arrow. Pull it back. And the deeper you go and the more sincere you are before the words come out of your mouth, you can't be real about your davening if you're waiting for the phone to ring in the middle. When you're standing in the middle of shul and the phone starts ringing, because you think, that's not a sincere davening. And even if it does ring, if you think you have to answer it, I'm talking to God and I got to answer my phone. Whoever's calling me will call me later. I'm talking to God right now. But that's what the Kutzker says. You're not deep. If you can have a half a minute to answer the phone in the middle of davening, then you're not deep. You're not giving it all you got. You're not sincere about the thank you. You're not sincere about the maybe, about the please. You're not talking to God from a real place. Let it ring. Whoever it is will get me 10 minutes later. That's life. The further you pull back in the bow, the more accurate, the stronger, the more effect that arrow will have when it hits its target. Rav Hirsch says that every Jew, Shamshon Rav Hirsch says, that every Jew has his own hue of color. And each one has his own individual character trait and aspect. But when you all come together, you make the white light. It's kind of like the light in the rainbow. It's all white light. As a people, we are united. There's one light. But each person has his own shade of the color of the rainbow. And as a people, when we come together, we give off tremendous light. But we can't forget that each one of us has his own obligation to do his job the way he understands it and to continue with what he does. So says our Shamshon Rav Hirsch. So the rainbow in the cloud is very, very instructive. Why? It teaches that light breaks through darkness and that there can be a positive result from darkness as well. The force is present within every single Jew. Hashem said, this is a sign I'm going to show you. There is a force in every single Jew where light can break through darkness. The rainbow appearing in the clouds is Hashem's way of telling us to never give up. There's always a chance. There's always hope. There's always an opportunity. Never, ever, ever give up. The rainbow was created at twilight, just before Shabbos, because at twilight is when we have the synthesis of darkness and light. That's when that mixture takes place. It's supposed to be created at that point, the rainbow, because the rainbow is going to be what shows us that we as the individuals have the ability to bring light into any dark situation. When things look horrible, the world's going to be destroyed, the rainbow shows you from Hashem that there will be peace. Interestingly, the sign of Sagittarius is a bow, but it's not a rainbow. It's an archer. It's not just the bow, it's the archer, the whole archer with the bow and arrow. Why is that? Because the archer shows that it is the individual who directs what happens with the bow. The bow can be positive, the bow can be negative. The bow can be showing peace, the bow can be showing war. The bow can go either direction. It's the person behind the bow that determines what's going to happen to that arrow. It's going to determine if the bow is facing towards you or away from you. And now we can understand what it has to do with Chanukah. And now we can start getting into the concept of what Keshes and Sagittarius has to do with Chanukah. During the month of Kislev, the days get shorter, lightness gets less and less light, the nights are longer, more and more darkness in the world. The Greeks, when they came and they attacked us, try to do the same thing. They try to bring more darkness into the world by taking away Torah, by taking away our opportunity to do mitzvahs, by not allowing us to do certain activities and actions. That was their way of creating a lack of Torah, which takes away light, so to speak, and by creating more darkness, more of their philosophy to go into the world and to function that way. When we light Hanukkah candles, what we're doing is, that's our way of acknowledging the victory of light over darkness. the archer taking control of his bow and bringing light into the world. Every time you light a candle during Hanukkah, you're showing that I have the power, the ability to bring light into the world. The rainbow is formed when a ray of light goes through a dark cloud. That's what we have the ability to do. We have the ability to bring light into darkness. And the light of Hanukkah is the ultimate spiritual light being cast through the attempted darkness of the Greeks. And in every generation, we face darkness. There are always people trying to wipe us out, always people trying to stifle us from doing what we do. We're always ashamed of this and that. But we have the ability and the power to bring the light back into existence. You know, the very, very first class that I ever gave when I came to the shul, before I was even hired, my prabashir, so to speak, was a class on Hanukkah. And I'm going to repeat something I said then, because I don't know if everybody was there, if you remember it or not. We spoke about the 36 lights and the 36 hours of Friday. And I'm going to go through this very quickly for you. The way it worked in the 6 days of creation is there was evening and there was day. Let's say it was an even day. 6 in the morning to 6 at night was daytime. 6 at night to 6 in the morning was nighttime. 12-hour equal days. Fine. Friday morning, sun rises, 6 o'clock. Beautiful event. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, God creates Adam. 3 o'clock, God creates Eve. 4 o'clock, the snake coerces Eve into eating from the fruit in the Garden of Eden. 5 o'clock, God confronts Adam and Eve and says, "What'd you do?" And as they're getting closer to 6 o'clock, Chava Eve takes a look and sees it's starting to get dark out. Says the Zohar HaKadosh, she never saw darkness before. She was created in the afternoon when there was light. She thought she destroyed the world. Says the Zohar that Chava looked at God and said, "It's my fault, I destroyed the whole world." The Zohar says that Hashem looks at God and said, "If you believe you have the power to destroy the world, why don't you also believe you have the power to create the world?" It takes the same force and the same drive and the same energy to create as it does to destroy. So if you believe one, you can believe the other as well. Says the Zohar, at that moment, two angels came and brought Chava two candles. I know other people say fire was created Matzoy Shabbos. I'm not going into that now. But they brought Chava two candles, and Chava lit Shabbos candles at that moment. And God granted Adam and Chava that they can stay in the Garden of Eden until Matzoy Shabbos, and he didn't cast them out of the Garden of Eden until after Shabbos. But the other thing that happened was that it never got dark Friday night. The light that was shining during the days of creation is what is called the Or HaGanuz, the hidden light. That was a very special light. God took that light, and God said, "I'm going to hide this light." The light that we have now from the sun and the moon, that's not the same light that existed during the days of creation. That was called the Or HaGanuz, the hidden light. God took that light, and he hid it for tzaddikim of the world to come. And he allowed that light to shine through the entire Shabbos. It never got dark that Shabbos. And then afterwards, God hid that light, and Adam and Chava went down to the physical world the way we know it. He asked the Zohar, "Where did God hide it? It's very nice. He hid the light. Where did he put it?" And the answer is Torah Or. The light was hidden in the Torah. And it's available for the tzaddikim. It's available for Talmidei Chachamim. It's available for people who know how to learn and to look at the Torah to extract the light of Torah. So now think for a second. Friday morning, sun came up. It was light. From Friday morning, 6 o'clock, to Friday night during creation, it's 12 hours. From Friday night, 6 o'clock until Motzoi Shabbos, it stayed light. That's 24 hours. 24 hours and 12 hours is 36 hours. The Or HaGanuz, the light that shone from Friday morning until Motzoi Shabbos, shone for 36 hours without getting dark. 36 lights. We always talk about Lamed Vav Tzadikim, that there are 36 Tzadikim in every generation that carry the light from generation to generation, that carry the Torah. 36 candles is the number of candles that we light during Hanukkah. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8 equals 36. I'm not talking about the Shamas. That's not part of the mitzvah. That's a different thing. 36 candles. Each of these candles represents one of the lights from that hour of creation. And Chazal tells us, not even the Kabbalistic Svarim, even other Svarim tell you, that if a person takes the time to sit with the candles and meditate, and you take the half hour off, you don't eat the latke for half hour. You don't do whatever it is for half hour. You lit candles, you sit with the light, and you just sit and you allow yourself to absorb and internalize the light. You can actually experience and feel the connection to the Or HaGadol, to that special light that is put away for tzaddikim. And that light can infuse you with a desire, with an energy to want to shine forth and give you the power to help get through darkness through the light that's available. The Gemara has a debate. The Gemara says, when you have a Navi, a prophet, and a Talmud Chacham, a learned man, and they disagree with each other, who do you listen to? My immediate reaction would think, hey, I gotta listen to the prophet, right? He's a prophet. Gemara says, no, you don't listen to the prophet. You listen to the Talmud Chacham. Why? The prophet, at best, we're not talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, but any prophet after Moshe Rabbeinu only sees everything through a veiled lens. The lens is not clear. In a dream, and for his prophecy to be true, other prophets have to have the same prophecy, and he may misinterpret that which he reads. But a Talmud Chacham, says the Gemara, who's seeing it in the Torah, he's seeing the 36 lights of creation. He's bringing back into existence the light that was there from pre-creation, from day one. That is a light. That is information that he has that you can't ignore. And the bigger the Talmud Chacham, obviously, the more learned, the more he understands the depth of what he's learning, the more he can extract. I'm not talking about somebody who's tainted with outside information. Somebody whose knowledge is pure, and pure Torah knowledge can bring out the light and the essence of what was meant to be in creation. So we have two Yamim Tovim throughout the year that don't come out in the time of a full moon. Pesach is the 15th of the Hebrew month, full moon. Sukkot, full moon. Even Shavuos is an extension of Pesach. It's on the 7th of the month. Okay, it's not a full moon, but it's close to it. The only two Yom Tovim that we have is we say, Tiku b'chodesh shofar, I will blow with the shofar, b'kesev yom chageinu, when the moon is hidden, because on the first of the month, there's no moon on the first of the Hebrew month. Rosh Hashanah is a day where there's no moon, and it's dark, so to speak. And the second one is Chanukah. Chanukah comes out on the 25th of the month and goes to the end of the month where there's no moon whatsoever, and it's hidden. The same word kesa, by kesa yom chagenu, hidden. The word kislev, which is the month of Chanukah, is made up of the word kis, which means hidden, lamed vav, 36. The 36 lights that are hidden in the menorah, are hidden in the light of the menorah, can be brought out by us from the menorah, and therefore you don't need the moonlight. Because we have the ability, once again, the same lesson of the bow, of the keshes, we have the ability to extract light in a place of darkness. That is the whole point of kislev, the 36 that are hidden, and our responsibility to extract that darkness and the light from the darkness and to bring it and bring light back into the world. So let's see one more thing that took place here. I said, besides my birthday, and besides the mabul that we said took place in the month of Kislev, I'm going to give you on a very, very surface level, without going into the depths, because we only have a few minutes, something else that I find amazing that took place during the month of Kislev. The Sefer Yetzirah says that every month of the Hebrew calendar, we all know Hashem's name, we say it in davening all the time, is a yud and a hey, and then a vav and then a hey. I'm not going to get into the deep mathematics. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to go crazy here. But every month has a yud and then a hey. That's Hashem's name. Yud, hey, vav, hey. Every month of the year, now yud, hey, vav, hey, we know equals 26. We've spoken about that many, many times. Every month of the year has a different assortment of those letters. That letter can be yud, hey, vav, hey. It can be yud, vav, hey, hey. It can be hey, hey, yud, vav. You can rearrange that letter many, many different ways. Anybody who knows basic mathematics knows, if you want to know how to figure out how many different ways you can arrange four letters, it's 1 times 2 times 3 times 4. 1 times 2 is 2 times 3 is 6 times 4 is 24. However, there's two hays, the same letter. So if you have two of the same letter, it cuts it in half. So there are 12 different possible ways of arranging those four letters. Each month of the year in the Hebrew calendar has a different assortment of those letters in a different order. And every one of the different assortments of those letters has a pasuk in the Torah that the first letter of the pasuk or the last letter of the pasuk will line up with that word, and we'll see in a minute what that means, to tell you what how it represents that month. Quickly, each letter, Hashem's name, 26, that's the value. 12 months of the year, so it's 26 times 12. 26 times 12 is how much? Anybody quickly? 312. 312 is the word chodesh, the word month. So every chodesh, every month of the year, has a different representation of Hashem's energy, which is structured through the different organization of the letters of His name. Why am I mentioning any of this? The pasuk that corresponds to the month of Tishrei of Kislev, the order of the letters that correspond to the month of Kislev is Vav Yud Hey Hey. That's the order. If you look in your art scroll Siddur during Rosh Chodesh, when you're davening Rosh Chodesh in the Siddur, it tells you every single month what the order of the letters are. You're supposed to have that in mind while you're saying Musaf on Rosh Chodesh. Okay, you look in the Siddur later on, you'll see that. But for the month of Kislev, it's Vav Yud Hey Hey. Where is that pasuk derived from? So when Yaakov Avinu was being buried, which we're going to read about next Shabbos in Parshas Vayechi, Vayigash Vayechi, the end of Chanukah, we're going to read that. When Yaakov Avinu was being buried, the Canaanites came out and they saw this big to-do of what was going on. And the pasuk says, Vayar Yoshev Haaretz Aknani, and they saw, the Canaanites saw what was going on, and they explains whatever they did. That pasuk, Vayar Yoshev Haaretz Aknani, the first letter of each of those words is a Vav, Vayar Yoshev Yud, Ha'aretz ha'hei, ha'knani ha'hei, vav yud ha'hei. So what's that got to do with Yaakov? Who cares? But so what? What am I making Yemeshiga for? So I'll tell you, I told you something else that happened in Kislev that I will tell you. All the others, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, were all died in the month of Tishrei. The difference is that Yaakov, after he died, was embalmed for 40 days. Torah tells us very specifically, he was Yosef, he had no choice, he couldn't go straight to burial. Yaakov was embalmed for 40 days, and then after being embalmed, for 30 days they mourned Yaakov. So he was not buried in the Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, he was not buried in Hebron until 70 days after he died in the month of Tishrei. 70 days after he died in the month of Tishrei, on Sukkot, 70 days later, is Kislev, Chanukah. That's the time when Yaakov Avinu passed away. And it is that reason that the pasuk that represents Hashem's name, and I'm telling you this only to show you, not that I understand it, not that it means a drop of anything to me, but this stuff is so deep and there is so much that is going on that just to cast it aside totally is as ridiculous as saying that it means nothing. You have to understand there's a lot going on here that we have no relation to. But what should we take out of it? What we should take out of it is everything that we can. The little things. The lighting of the menorah. The lighting of the lights. Recognizing 36 lights. Makes sense. 36 hours. These things do light up. And these things do make sense. Besides the name of Hashem in each month, there's also a letter of the Aleph Beis that corresponds to each month. And I'm going to finish up in a couple seconds with this. The letter that corresponds to the month of Kislev is a Samach. And the Chanukah also goes from Kislev right into Teves. It extends through into Teves. And Teves is Capricorn. We're not going to even start on that tonight. But the letter that represents the month of Teves is an Ayin. Samach is spelled Samach Mem Chof. Ayin is spelled Ayin Yud Nun. If you add up all those letters, it comes out to 250. 250 is in the word Ner, which means candle. Vahadvik Ner Chanukah. Once again, you see an association, a direct association, about how Ner, the light of Chanukah, travels through the month of Kislev into the month of Teves, and is already alluded to in the Torah way before the story of Chanukah took place. As a matter of fact, what I wanted to finish with, without going into a very, very detailed thing, the Torah can't discuss Chanukah because it didn't happen until years later. And yet there are so many allusions in the Torah for Chanukah. The very, very first word of Bereshis, if you rearrange the letters, instead of writing Beis Resh Aleph Shin Yud Tov, if you rearrange it to Yud Resh Tov Beis Shin Aleph, stands for Yeshua Rabbatia Bezman Sheyimlech Antiochus, which means a tremendous saving will take place when the time of Antiochus is king. And there are many, many, the 720 different permutations of that letter, of that word Bereshis, that you can rearrange it, and the Ramban and others tell us that Every one of the 613 mitzvahs, every one of the mitzvahs of the Rabbanon can all be alluded to in that very, very first word, Bereishis, by putting the letters in a different order and knowing what it stands for. And I'm just going to finish by telling you that in the Torah itself, if you look in Parshas Emor, which discusses all the Yom Tovim, it starts with Pesach, and then Atzeres, and then Rosh Hashanah, and then Yom Kippur, and then it says Sukkot, and then it says Vayidab Moshes Merad Hashem Bnei Yisrael. That's where we make Kiddush on Sukkot on Yontif, and Hashem spoke all these holidays to the Bnei Yisrael. The very next pasuk, nothing in between. The very next pasuk after Hashem talks about the holidays is Tzavos Bnei Yisrael command the Jewish people, and they should take for themselves Shemen Zayis Zoch, pure olive oil. You go straight from Sukkot right into taking oil. An allusion, everybody says, of course, to Hanukkah. And why does it follow Sukkot in that order? Because Sukkot is the only yontif that has 8 days. So therefore we go from 8 days of Sukkot into 8 days of Hanukkah. That's exactly what it's saying, an allusion to Hanukkah. Kosis Lamor, pure oil that's going to be used. It says the Rekeach, look at that pasuk. It says, Lahal Isner, to bring up a light. And then afterwards it says, Yarech es haneirois, you should set up the lights. Says the Rokeach, it shows you the halach is like Beis Hillel. You're starting with one light, and then you're increasing to many lights. The Torah itself, and the very, very psukim, even though the story never took place, is already alluding to you that there will be a Hanukkah. I'm just going to end by telling you the following. There are two holidays of the Rabbanon that we keep very strongly. Purim and Hanukkah. They're not Torah, nowhere in the Torah. We have Purim and Hanukkah. Purim is 2 days. According to Halacha, Purim and Shushan Purim, a lot of ways we have 2 days. A lot of halachas that apply on Purim, apply on Shushan Purim as well. And Hanukkah is 8 days. Together it's 10. It's just, hear me out, what can I tell you? I have to tell you this. There's 24 hours in a day. 10 days times 24 hours is 240. 240 is the numerical value of the word Amalek. Now everybody knows that on Purim, the job is to wipe out Amalek. But Amalek also has the same numeric value as the word Safek, which means doubt. That's what Amalek is about. The job that Amalek has is to create doubt within a person. To make you say maybe yes, maybe no. What people don't realize is that Hanukkah, the responsibility of Hanukkah is also to help wipe out Amalek. To help wipe out the concept of doubt. How? There's no bigger way to wipe out doubt than by bringing light into darkness. Doubt is darkness. You're not sure where to go, what to do, how to approach it. Unfortunately, how many times do you have people who question, how could God, why did God, how did it happen? We don't see the light. We don't know. Many times we don't see the light. We're clouded. We're blocked. We're not supposed to see the light. If we saw all the light, we'd be God. We're not. There's a lot of darkness. But if you connect to the lights when they're available to us, if you have faith in Hashem and you believe that everything Hashem gave us is preordained and predetermined, and we know that it's there, and we have the power, we are the archer, we're the one who pulls the string, we're the one who has the ability to decide, is that going to be war or is that going to be peace? We're the ones who have the ability to decide, is that going to be light or is that going to be darkness? That's the power of Kislev. That's the power of Sagittarius. That's the power of Hanukkah. And that's the power of lighting the candles and sitting and meditating with the lights, seeing the light, letting it permeate within, and allow a person to know, I can make a difference, I can make a change. And amidst Hashem, if we all go through Hanukkah, and we look at the lights, and we understand the lights, and we feel it, every one of us will be able to make a little change in our homes, which will extend to our community, which will expand to our city, to our town, to our country, to our land. And in Mirtz Hashem, the whole world will be a much, much better place because of the understanding of wiping out Amalek, wiping out God, wiping out doubt, and allowing God to do His thing.